You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 95. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about perspective from a postmenopausal brown girl in CRM. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch, or Ute Peoples, lands, Neta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Trish Fernandez on the show. Trish is the president and CEO of In Context, a small women and minority-owned corporation specializing in cultural resource management. She has over 30 years experience practicing cultural resources management in California. Her technical expertise is in historical archaeology, architectural history, and indigenous archaeology and ethnohistory of Northern California. She recently completed her tenure as the president of the Register of Professional Archaeologists, where she continued to work towards consistent professional standards and ethics, as well as removing barriers to creating a well-trained, diverse, and inclusive workforce. So welcome to the show, Trish.
Thank you very much, Jessica. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you. Trish and I have known each other through ACRA for the American Cultural Resources Association for a while now, and excited to have this excuse to catch up and hear more about your story. So to get us started, what got you interested in this type of work?
Well, I really didn't know that this work existed until my last semester, I think, in undergrad. I'm one of those people that came to this profession from a very circuitous route. I originally started college, studying business. And then I went into political science, as it was called way back then. And as part of my breadth requirements, I had to take some kind of science. And I was looking for the least sciencey of the sciences that didn't require a lot of, advanced math. And so I ended up taking physical anthropology. And at the same time, I was taking a cultural anthropology, 1A for another requirement. And it was the cultural anthropology class that it was like an epiphany. It was like, oh, my God, this is everything I want to know to the extent that I want to know it to the nth. And it was like a kind of like a religious conversion. I just almost through the end of the semester, I made a decision that I didn't care what I did for a living. This is what I wanted to study, because I felt like I could always make a living. I had been a legal secretary up to that point, an executive secretary, and I could figure my way around an office and business. So yeah, that was kind of how I started down the road. I was initially interested in anthropology, and actually I wanted to study how living populations, families, dealt with a child in the K-12 system in the United States being the major communicator. So kind of like, learning a second language. How does learning a second language affect the family dynamics? Because basically the assumption is that, the child becomes the main contact person and kind of gatekeeper for the family. So I knew that I would have to study linguistics, and I just didn't realize that the school that I went to really didn't have a strong linguistics program. And then when I took the first linguistics class, I was like, I don't like this. So I liked the abstract thought of it. I just wasn't really into, you know, mapping. I don't know, mapping things. It seemed like we were mapping thought. Anyway, maybe I don't understand linguistics, but it just didn't click with me. So I ended up taking a class. The last semester, you're supposed to take an aerial, like a, you know, regional archaeology. They didn't offer anything that I was really interested in. So I asked if I could substitute that class for a seminar they were having in the master's program in CRM. And so that I got a waiver to do that. And so that's how I learned about the profession. And I took a very quick liking to it. I've always been interested in law and procedure, and I just really liked it. We had a guest speaker one day that came to talk about the California Environmental Quality Act, and just the week before I had led the discussion. And so I asked a lot of good questions, and then afterwards she asked if I wanted to come and work for her.
Awesome.
So that's how I got into it. It was a long, strange trip, and it still is.
Well, and what was it? What was it like working for this person?
Well, originally I had already accepted a job at the Forest Service, so I went to go work for the Forest Service, which is a really good decision. Mm-hmm. I worked there for about 8 months, and then the season ended, and then I went to go work for this person. So,
oh, perfect.
It was amazing. This person ended up being my mentor and really giving me a lot of autonomy and confidence. We had a lot in common. So, you know, as I've grown to understand that people come in and out of your life, you know, and she's not really in my life anymore, but she was one of the most influential people in my life and in my career. And I will always be grateful for that.
Yeah. So what kind of work were you doing in those early years?
Oh, well, at that time I had my BA. I didn't have my MA. I wasn't committed, you know. So I was really just learning everything. I did a lot of writing. That's one of my strong points, and researching, which is another. And I just did whatever was available to me. And I caught on really quickly to the writing and also to the project management and the business side. And that really served me well in this industry. At the time, I had a daughter who was, gosh, how old was she then? 4. So she was still in preschool. And so I didn't feel comfortable leaving for extents of time. So most of the work that I did, I basically said, I'll do anything that's local. I'll do anything and everything that's local. I did get some experience doing some big surveys and excavations, but most of my work was small, a local agency or state agency CEQA work that sometimes had, a federal trigger. But there was times I was working on 20 projects at one time. So I got really good at managing kind of churn and burn projects. And it was just like rapid fire practice. So that's what I did. Not a lot of, you know, what you think you're going to do or what some people think they're going to do when they study archaeology or anthropology.
So it sounds like your boss at that point was pretty supportive of you being a mom. Is there things that you think would have been helpful, or that people who are in those more leadership roles today could do to better support moms?
I think it's gotten a lot better. I mean, this was in 95, 96, 97. And back then I was, you know, a minority in all kinds of different spheres. Not very many archaeologists had kids. And so it wasn't, I really didn't look to my employer to provide allowances. I looked to myself to figure out a way that it would work. I think that, I don't know, I really can't, I can't speak for other companies. I really don't know. It's a challenge. I will say that. I would be honest. It's a challenge. But I really think it's a challenge for the individual, because being in the field requires, I mean, if you're a dedicated field person, like our field work at In Context literally lasts from probably March to when the snow kicks us out, which varies every year. This year it was late December. So I think the individual needs to be responsible for identifying what they are willing to do, how much they're willing to be gone, how much they can afford to be gone. And I would hope that any employer would work with them to accomplish those goals, you know, whatever goals they have in their career. Everybody's different.
So, okay, you mentioned that you hadn't at that point gone for your master's. What triggered that decision?
Well, I wanted to give it a couple of years and be in the industry to see if I liked it and if I thought that I could be successful. And the answer to both those questions was yes. So I went back to school.
And was there like a particular focus that you were working on when you were in your master's?
Yeah, I was very focused, partly because I never had a lot of money. So I was paying for everything out of pocket. And I had a child, so I had to be very efficient with my time and all my resources. I also lived 50 miles away from the school and work. So during that time, I started looking at possible thesis subjects. And I really wanted to do something with Mexicans, so having to do mm-hmm. with Mexicans. Mm-hmm. And my professor at the time, who's since passed, Jerry Johnson, one of the best people I've ever known, suggested to me the idea of the Mexican miners in the gold rush. Because I also grew up in the Sierra Nevada in the gold rush, you know, a county. So I was very familiar with the landscape and history. And this was something that I didn't really know about. So it was really interesting. And so that's what I chose to focus on. So the title of my thesis was, good Lord.
I was going to say, I can't remember mine.
Yeah. Mexican miners in the Southern Motherlode, an anthropological or archaeological and political economic perspective.
Nice. I'm very impressed that you remember that. Was there a favorite takeaway? What did you learn about the Mexican workers in the gold rush?
Well, some things never change. Mm-hmm. The issues that seasonal and migrant workers experience today, they've been experiencing all along. A couple things. One is that I had to learn about Marxist theory. Mm-hmm. And somebody said, hey, this would be great for Marxist theory. And I'm like, okay, what's that?
That's what grad school's for.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Yeah.
So that was probably the most difficult part of it, is just wrapping my head around learning a whole new language. And you know, I tend to try to make things harder than they are. But that was another just amazing opening of a whole new universe for me. It's like, this is exactly how I think. I didn't realize it, but this all makes sense to me. And why is everybody so afraid of it? It required me to make some connections outside of California. The people that helped me along the way there were Mark Walker, who is now at Sonoma State University, and Randy McGuire. I actually reached out to Randy McGuire because I read his book on a Marxist archaeology. And so they really helped me understand and be able to analyze things from those perspectives. And then reading Europe and the People Without History by Eric Wolff, I really used his examples and his framework to understand the phases that the economy went through in the gold rush. It was like a compressed phase of, you know, the world of economy. Anyway.
So we are already at our first break point, but when we come back, I definitely want to see where you went from your master's. So we will be right back here in a second. Okay, so we're back from our break and just wanted to revisit what we were talking about right before the break and then talk about what you did after your master's. But was there anything else that you wanted to add about your thesis and what you found interesting?
Well, a couple things that I learned. The whole thesis was, there was an assumption that the Mexican population could not be found archaeologically or in the documents. And I realized nobody had tested that hypothesis. So I tested that hypothesis. And I found that they could be found in the documents, but they were treated a lot like the Chinese, where like in the census records, you'd have pages of people that just said, you know, Chinese, and they didn't get individual names, or Mexicans. So that was difficult. And during that time frame, there wasn't, you know, the state of California was just getting its act together. So there wasn't a lot of documents, except for like mining claims, and a lot of the Mexicans didn't actually have mining claims. They worked on them. So that was interesting. And they do have an archaeological presence, but like any ethnic group, you have to be careful about being quick to assign. Every chili bottle does not a Mexican site make.
Since everybody loves it.
Across the board. Yeah, but there was other things like religious items and specific food items and horse riding accoutrements, specific types of tools that they use for mining. And then the other thing that I learned is that Mexicans have been, and before they were called Mexicans, indigenous people of the southern part of our continent, have always been coming north to do seasonal work. They conducted mining for a long time before the gold rush. And it was, to them, it was just another mining discovery that they went to go work at between the harvest and, you know, agricultural times that they had to go work in their home. So seeing that really gave me a different perspective on, you know, how we view immigration and seasonal work and migrant workers. This isn't a new thing, and it predates our country.
So, after doing all of that work, when you finished your master's, what route did you take from there?
Well, I stayed at the company that hired me. Mm-hmm. It was a medium-sized environmental consulting company. And then got to a point where I was ready to make a change. And then I went to a small CRM-only company. Was there for about 4 years. And then I worked for a local agency for about 4 years. And then I went back to the company that I had started out at that had been acquired by an international company and was transferred to Seattle. And then a year later, I was laid off.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had not been in Seattle long enough to really grow any roots.
Yeah.
I did look for work up there, but nothing really took. So I came back to the Northern California area, but this was right in the middle of the recession and nobody was hiring. I applied for any level job in CRM, and I did work for SRI for a while, but it was slow and I wasn't able to bring in any work, and I didn't feel right about being mostly overhead for them. So I left and eventually started a sole proprietorship, which I had started earlier when I had worked for the local agency, but it was like a reboot. And just started doing some, you know, side work. And that eventually became in context. That was in 2012 that I rebooted my sole proprietorship, and then in 2015 incorporated. Mostly because I realized that I had to start hiring employees, and you know, the liability in that as a sole proprietor is much higher than if you're a corporation.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Did you have a vision in those early days when you were first, like either when you were with the agency or when you did the reboot, of what you wanted in context to be? Or was it more like, oh, this is just something that like I personally can do, you know, in this tough moment for the market?
Well, at the time, I was really just trying to pay my bills.
Mm-hmm.
Unemployment had run out, and I was pretty strapped. And really, it was the only thing that I could fall back on that I knew I could make, you know, more, the most, an hour, I guess. But all through my career, I'd always had a vision for the kind of workplace that I thought was ideal. And so I always brought that to wherever I was. And I didn't really realize it until after, you know, after the company got off its on its feet, that this was my opportunity to make that a reality. So there were probably 4 or 5 really, really hard years, and I'm understating it right now. It was pretty devastating being laid off, and the group that I, you know, people that I thought were my friends turned out not to be really what I consider a friend. And I felt very alone, and had to kind of scratch my way out of a hole. But yeah, once I was able to, you know, get the company somewhat on its feet, I thought, you know what? And it wasn't like an epiphany, like, oh, I get to do my own thing. I've always kind of done my own thing, which is probably why I didn't fit in anywhere else. I've always been an advocate for transparency and honesty and treating employees well, making sure that, you know, when I always thought of myself when I was a manager as I work for them. I may make more money, but my job is to make their job easier and to help them and give them everything, you know, clear the way for them. And that wasn't always easy to do in a more corporate or agency environment.
Yeah. I mean, I started my company in a better moment than a recession, but I will agree with you that it's rough and it takes a lot longer than people think that it will to get it going. And so anyone out there that's starting a business, starting consulting, you know, it does take a long time and it's not you.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just hard.
It's really hard. Thing.
Yeah,
it is. It's like having a child.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when you have more employees, it's like having a family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. We could talk about that all day.
Yeah. Yeah. So as it grew in context, were there specific ways that since then you've really been able to like implement some of those things that, you know, you were hoping for when you were an employee for somebody else, or that, you know, you had in your vision about how you wanted a workplace to be?
Yeah. Well, one of the first things that I wanted to be very careful about was understanding the labor laws. And it's such a maze in California. There's a lot of laws and there's no place that says this is how you need to do this. It's like, well, if you want to do it this way, you have to do it like this, and you could do this or you could do this, but then you have to do that. And then you have to track it like this. And that's only for this type of employee, but not for that type of employee. So it's just a big bowl of spaghetti. But I knew that there were some companies out there that maybe weren't necessarily, you know, abiding by the laws or taking the cheapest way, you know, especially with like field crew. And some of the laws have changed and the industry has changed so that things have gotten better. But like when I was in the 90s and even in the early 2000s, it was pretty common for people to go out in the field and they'd have to share a room, or, you know, you get minimal amount for meals. Maybe you get paid travel one way, but not another way. And it just didn't seem very consistent. So that's something that we look at every year. We look at all the labor laws, and now we have an attorney to help us with that. But even attorneys have different ways of interpreting things. And unless they're familiar with our industry, it makes it really difficult to get to where they understand what we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, people may be gone for literally months at a time. And, you know, so when they're gone and they have a day off, do they still get a per diem?
Yeah.
Do we pay for their time to go back home? And, you know, all those things that you don't really realize are questions until they come up as an issue. But so aside from that, though, I started out with a very clear description of the levels of, you know, how you can move up in the company and what I thought was necessary at certain stages for to be successful in CRM generally, not just for as an archaeologist. And a lot of companies, I think, that are CRM only, that employ a lot of archaeologists, focus, at least they used to, focus on the archaeology. So you're either a field person or you're a project manager.
Right.
And it still is really hard to meld those two, but I'm constantly trying to remind people that, you know, yeah, focus on your field now, but don't forget about this other, these other things that are really important. And there may come a time when you either don't want to be in the field or you can't be in the field or whatever. You need to learn the whole side of the business, the whole parts of what this industry is. And they don't teach that in college. So that, and I have always been transparent about who makes what, which isn't always easy to manage, but it forces management to make sure that we can support our decisions and justify those, explain those to employees that may not be getting, you know, a raise. And they came up with this group and maybe you're not getting a raise, but this other person is, or they're getting promotion and you're not. It really holds us accountable. And I think that's really, really important. When we started, when I started the company, of course, I was the sole owner. And there have been a handful of people that have been extremely committed. And so about 3 years ago, we started on a succession plan. And I started gifting. I don't know what, I can't think of a better word right now, but as part of their compensation at the end of the year, they acquire more shares as part of their, you know, compensation. Mm-hmm. So that was supposed to take 7 years, and I decided to speed that up last year because we were having a profitable year and I wanted to share that. So, you know, so that they would get dividends. And so that all happened to the extent that the shares were going to be transferred. And then our plan is to have, after, if somebody's been there for 5 years, then they are also eligible to have shares as their compensation. So we truly are employee owned. I know there's a lot of companies that are ESOPs and say they're employee owned, which is technically true. But, you know, an ESOP can also be, the decisions for the company may not trickle down to the people who are part of the ESOP.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At least that's my understanding. I can't say that I'm an expert in ESOPs, but I have heard of companies, you know, revoking or changing their minds about the ESOP, or,
ooh,
you know, that doesn't seem, not necessarily CRM companies, but other,
yeah, wow,
companies. So,
Okay. Well, we are at our second break point, but excited to hear more. I know it always goes so fast about In Context when we get back. All right. So for our last segment, I'd really love to hear about some of the work that you did in Context, you and your team, obviously, and if there are some examples of projects that you're like really proud of or highlights for you over the years.
Okay. Well, when I, my niche is really CEQA projects. Those are projects that are required to comply with California Environmental Quality Act. So those are state and local agencies who have to comply. So a lot of my clients in the beginning were environmental companies that don't necessarily have a cultural resources component, or their component lacks in some kind of expertise that I had. But early on, Jesse Phillips joined as a partner, and his expertise is completely different from mine. He does big excavations, big surveys in mountainous areas. And at the time, he had a lot of experience with federal work, so the federal government as client. So initially, our work was mostly the CEQA side. And so there was one project that we got really early on. There was a hotel development in Napa. And it turned in, they were basically removing a mound for this hotel. And it required CEQA and Section 106. And it was, Jesse was required on that because of his expertise in excavating and osteology. We ended up, it's probably the most interesting site that I've ever been involved with. It was just amazing. We worked excavating for a full year.
Wow.
And people came out of retirement to work on the project. It was just amazing. The compliance side was not all that great. The initial work that was done for CEQA was questionable, and the specific district of the Corps at that time didn't have an archaeologist reviewing anything. And so, you know, some of the procedures, some of the 106 procedures weren't entirely followed. So the project ran into some problems because of that, and they're kind of retooling, and we'll see what happens. But we did do the data recovery to the extent that the treatment plan called for before construction, but they're also going to need to construct the project, whatever that is decided to be. But that was probably the best project we've had. It was really challenging because it was early on. We didn't have enough money. all of those, you know, early problems.
Mm-hmm. Cash flow.
Yeah. Cash flow is always an issue. But we made it. And so those come around maybe once every 3 to 5 years, and we always learn something new from them. As much as you try to plan for the unexpected, it seems like there's always something that goes awry. And at the same time, there's this kind of, I don't even know what to call it, this other aspect when you're dealing with human burials. I don't know if you want to call it a spiritual aspect, or it's not anything that you can really pinpoint, but it takes its toll on people. And it just the fact of, you know, having to remove humans from what should have been their final resting place, and getting to know these people so intimately, it's an emotional toll.
Yeah.
So that was a good one. We could go on and talk about that project. It was really, the crew camped out on site in the middle of Napa, which was really interesting. And then we ended up.
Yeah, I was going to say, how was that?
Yeah. It was like old, like the good old days. But some other really interesting. We did an ethnography, and that was this was as part of a controversial project up here in California, and it was one of the treatments for 106. Mm-hmm. But we started it right when COVID started. So we couldn't meet with anybody. And yeah. As you know, the indigenous population, they got hit hardest.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially the elders.
Yes. Yeah. So we couldn't do the typical, let's go drive around and talk about what you see. And so we had to really, we had to pivot and rely on more ethnohistory, which was a disappointment, but it made us kind of dive deeper into the integration of how ethnohistory and historical documents and maps and really tie into the archaeology. And what I found was that, a lot of times people will say, well, here's an archaeological site, and this is the same place where there's a village, so it must be the village. Hmm. Without really looking at the diagnostic periods, So, yeah, this was an ethnographic village, but what you've got here is something else, or you have villages that moved because of the total displacement. So you could have an early site near an ethnographic village, but it's actually the same place. They just had to move a little bit because of either flooding or they combined populations because the population was decimated. So it really made me realize that we need to be a little more, we need to dive deeper into the data and how they correlate with one another. And, it's the same story like with architectural history and archaeology. I mean, there were so many times when I'd go into a project and people had been there already surveying, but there had been three different survey teams. There was a prehistoric team, as it was called, a historical archaeology team, and then a building team. Mm-hmm. And looking at the same place. And so they're recording things in different manners and not really talking to each other. So it's kind of the same thing, add to that the ethnographic data. When people become specialized, we really lose sight of the whole site and lose an understanding of what the place is. And that's because we've become very material oriented,
Yeah.
That was one of the reasons why I did not want to be an archaeologist when I started going to college. I thought they're all just interested in things, and I'm not interested in things. I'm interested in people and places and mm-hmm. and what happened. How does this speak to who we are as humans? But I digress.
I was going to say, you're a cultural anthropologist at heart.
I am. Yeah. And I don't understand why all archaeologists aren't. It's mm-hmm. it's always shocking to me. Yeah. There's a lot of things going on in California with NAGPRA, and people are just, up in arms about certain things that I don't understand. There is the compromise, I think.
Anyway. Yeah. I mean, as a cultural anthropologist, I don't know why everybody doesn't want to be a cultural anthropologist either.
Yeah.
I'm not at all biased on this one.
Yeah. Oh. So most recently, all of Jesse's proposal work has really come to fruition. And I would say probably 70 to 80% of our work right now is with federal contracts. Mm. And a lot of that is for vegetation control, which is basically fire management. So he's been amazing at building a team that is really responsive and learning what each forest district wants, because, you know, it's all a little bit different, and really, you know, performing just amazing things. So that's been, it's been great, because, you know, it's the kind of work that people think about when they think about, you know, archaeology and CRM, going out and surveying and recording sites and, you know, doing all that fun stuff. But it's been difficult for me because I've had to shift my focus on really understanding the federal government. So that's how I spent 2024 getting to understand these projects a little bit better. And now I'm starting to step away, now that we've basically had to create a structure that would support that, because our structure really didn't, our infrastructure, our systems and stuff, they weren't really built for that. So it's always something, but it's good work. And it's allowed us to grow, and it's allowed us to keep our core team and keep them, you know, progressing in their career, which is really where my heart is, you know, mm-hmm. just making sure that people have a good foundation and they know what the options are and that they get to choose those, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you had your soapbox, basically, of what you want the whole world to know. I mean, that could be the public, that could be other CRM firms, that could be archaeologists, whatever. Like, what do you want to tell the world?
Oh, within the parameters of CRM?
Yeah, within the parameters of I mean, I was going to say we get into all kinds of things if we
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, my heart has always been in advocacy for the people that do the work, mm-hmm. and making sure that they have the tools that they need, that they're represented fairly, that they're treated fairly, and that they have opportunities. And honestly, I don't see how that can happen without a union. So I am in full support of a union of archaeologists. I understand that at this point in my career, I can't really be that involved, except to say I'm in full support. And most of the time when I go and talk or give a presentation at a professional organization, it's about labor, and it's about providing a pathway and removing barriers, removing locks on the gates that require that everybody has a master's degree to be called an archaeologist or a professional archaeologist. I think that's absolutely ridiculous. And it makes me sad. It's discrimination. It's mean. It's petty. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, it doesn't do the industry any good. So we're at a point right now where, oh shoot, we don't have enough people who actually know how to do this business. Well, why is that? It's because we as a profession have not shared what it is that we do with academic institutions so that they know how to prepare students. And at the same time, we said, well, also you have to have a master's degree, even though it's demonstrated over and over again that you don't need a master's degree to do this work. So in our company, we typically hire people that are just about to graduate with a BA, because honestly, if we hire somebody that has an MA, we have to pay them more and treat them the same teach them the same things. And we have to slowly get them to understand that they don't know what they're doing. You know, I mean, you may know how to excavate a site, you may be able to identify materials, but that's, I don't know, it's 20% of what we do. So,
yeah.
That would be my biggest soapbox. It's been really difficult. I've been trying to address this in a lot of different fronts at a lot of different levels for the past 20 years. And to quote one of my favorite Mel Brooks movies, I'm tired. Verklunk.
You're what? Did you say, well, I'm verklunked?
The saying, I don't know what the word is. It says everything from the waist down is for something.
Oh, I don't know.
I didn't want to say that out loud. It's lazy styles. Like,
be still my Jewish heart. Well, probably it is for Clemson. It's been a while since I've seen Blazing Saddles. Something to revisit. But yeah, I think, aren't they all speaking Yiddish in Blazing Saddles or something, if I remember correctly?
Anyway. And German, and yeah.
Side notes.
Anyway. Yeah, I think that's the most important thing to me. When everything, you know, of course, I love archaeology. I love anthropology. I love the questions that it could possibly answer. I don't know if we're focused on that anymore. I think the industry has kind of lost sight of what we're a part of, you know, the anthropology. Mm-hmm. And, but I, you know, I still get excited when I see something, you know, amazing. One of the coolest things is when we, for that site in Napa, when we started doing some ethnographic research, I'm pretty sure that we found that three of the individuals that were recovered can be identified by name.
Oh, wow.
Because of mission records and the amazing work that Randall Milliken did. Yeah, just so that's still left to be proven. But when we get back on the project, then that's something that we'll be looking into. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. Because the way that they died, there is a number of people and the time period is basically a story of this village of people had resisted the missions. And there was a group of neophytes that left one of the Bay Area missions to go find people who had left, had run off. And they ended up at this village, and the people in the village knew about it ahead of time. And so they hid, and they ended up killing them and then mutilating them so that they couldn't run, you know, be fully functional in the afterlife. And the mutilations were described, and there's a lot of evidence that points to that those are the people that left the mission, the neophytes, that and to go find the runaways.
Well, what a note to end on. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show today, and always good.
It's fun.
And it was, yeah, it was super interesting to hear more of your story and the work that you're doing to advocate for people in the CRM field. So thank you for all of that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.